And of course, it continues. Robert Schock is going to join us in a moment. We're going to talk about some of the catastrophes that have hit the good old planet. And of course, Gary Evans stays with us as well, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Gary Evans, of course, staying with us. Robert Schock joining us. He is a full-time faculty member at Boston University. Dr. Schock earned his PhD in geology and geophysics at Yale. He's been very instrumental in spurring renewed attention into the interrelationships between astronomical and geological phenomena, natural catastrophes, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Robert, always a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
How have your travels been for you lately?
Very good. In fact, I've been traveling. I seem to travel a lot, I think. And most recently, I don't know if we want to get into it, at some point I was in Indonesia looking at this site of Gunung Padang, which ties right in with the story we've been talking about.
Absolutely. We will bring that up. Of course, last time you and I talked, we were kicking around the pyramid, the Hall of Records, what might be hidden along at the base of the Sphinx. What's the latest with Zahi Hawass, Robert? I lost track after they hosted it.
This is a difficult question. I was actually speaking with Robert Bouval. I think people know Robert Bouval from the Ryan correlation on the Giza Plateau. And according to Robert Bouval, and I don't want to say too much because I don't want to say, misspeak, but Zahi is potentially under investigation for a number of different things, during the old regime. And it's essentially a mess in Egypt as far as such things go. And there were a lot of improprieties, should we say, allegedly during the old regime under his reign, I'll call it.
I kind of suspected something was afoot.
Yeah, and I there are certain things, to be honest, certain things I heard and know that I'm not at liberty to say. So
maybe
we have
like
to sort of wait and see how things shake out. My understanding is he's in the United States at the moment, but I cannot confirm that.
Ah, okay. And by the way, say hi to Gary. He's on the other end of the line.
Hello, Gary.
Hi, Robert. Good morning.
Very good. Thank you.
Looking forward to this. How did you two get together, Robert? How did you get together with Gary?
We first met, I believe, at various conferences. I'm not sure if it was a Walter Cruttenden CPAC, that's Conference on Precession Ancient Knowledge Conference, or somewhere along the lines. Gary, do you remember when we first met?
Yes, that's right. It was at the CPAC conference.
That's what I thought.
We've met a number of times since then, including in Egypt.
Yes, yes. Our paths seem to cross quite a bit. And if all goes well, am I allowed to say this, Gary? I think we're planning a trip to Egypt.
We are very excited about it.
But
you guys stay safe when you do that, because there was a report just a few weeks ago that some of the extremists out there were telling tourists don't show up. So do be careful, Robert. And Gary.
Oh, absolutely. Always try to be very careful.
Anything new with the Hall of Records at the foot of the Sphinx? Edgar Casey's one of his favorite little projects.
Yes, well,
you found something. You found a chamber down there.
We found a chamber. When I say we, Thomas DeBecky, geophysicist I was working with at the time, and myself, we found a chamber under the left paw, which is really where Casey suggested there was going to be a chamber. And some people have heard the story before. Those that haven't, we found it using seismic techniques that essentially using a sledgehammer on a steel plate to put sound vibrations into the ground. And picture, or sort of people now know ground penetrating radar, similar type of technique to image what is underneath there. We found a chamber under the left paw, which had not previously been known. I got a call after we published this from the ARE, Association for Research and Enlightenment, from one of Casey's sons, saying, well, that's where his father predicted the chamber would be, the Hall of Records. It's probably flooded at this point. I very desperately want to get there, back to Egypt, and get permission to go into it. And I'm hoping, against hope, that the new regime will allow that at some point.
You may be able to get in this time. I, however, long suspected that maybe the other regime may have gotten into that Hall of Records.
I have
took,
sus- I have suspected that too. And again, this might tie back to our friend Zahi Hawass and exactly what was going on there. If we can get into it and see what's going on in there, I think we will answer that question among others.
How deep is it, Robert?
We're probably talking 10, 15 meters below the surface bedrock.
30 feet. Now, was it covered in sand because of years, or did they dig it from underneath there and they wanted it?
No, I think what has happened, I think the situation that we're going to find is this. It's in bedrock. Now, how do you get into bedrock? I don't believe there's an entrance anywhere around the base of the Sphinx. Some people say, well, it's between the paws of the Sphinx. There's this stela that maybe there's a doorway behind that. I don't believe that's the case. What we found was if you picture the Sphinx, it actually sits down below the ground level. They had to carve the bedrock down, and only the head stands above ground level, original ground level. In front of the Sphinx is what is known as the Sphinx Temple. And then in front of that, there's a lot of sand to this day. When we did seismic lines along that region, we found that there's a very steep cliff face, 15, 20 meters, 25 meters of cliff face below the sand level that you see now. And I think it's in that cliff face that there's an entrance, essentially a tunnel that will then go back toward the Sphinx and into this chamber under the paw. So I believe that is where the entrance is. That's my best estimate of where it is.
That's
exciting. To remove that much sand is going to be quite an undertaking if we're going to find the original entrance. My proposal, or one of my proposals, would be simply to drill into the bedrock to put some type of fiber optic camera down to at least image what is in the chamber initially.
Good idea. What do you think might be in there?
Well, if Casey's right, it's the Hall of Records. There could be some kind of literally records, whether those are carved on stone or whether it's some kind of more consumable leather, parchment, something like that. I just don't know. One thing I can say is that when we did the seismic work, it gave every signature, if you would, seismic signature, that there is something in the chamber. It is not an empty chamber. There are objects in the chamber.
You mean like many or just one big thing?
No, I think many. That would be, my best analysis.
Gosh, what if they find a craft, a UFO ship down there?
One could speculate. Look, we found it would be from a later period or is from a later period, but we found, for instance, the Dead Sea Scrolls and a number of things like that with Nag Hammadi documents in Upper Egypt, the Gnostic documents that they're sometimes referred to. So who knows what we could find. It could be really game-changing, as they say.
This could be exciting stuff.
Yeah.
My gosh. What if the Ark of the Covenant is hidden in there?
One never knows. After all, that is an Egyptian phenomenon, our Egyptian concept. When you go to Egypt, and Gary knows this well, you find arks. This is an Egyptian concept of having an ark holding sacred documents or sacred statues, sacred treasures. That is really, it's not, people think of it as Judaism. Well, Judaism, where did it originate? It originated from Egypt.
Gary, you've been working on a TV treatment. Tell me about that.
Yes, well, one of the big questions that comes to my mind when I'm at these ancient sites, because I'm trying to spread the information that I find useful, bring awareness to these subjects. So the question is, what's relevant and useful to just your average person that has a busy life, stresses of work? How can we boil some of this down to make a difference? And so the treatment that I'm working on with Robert, Power Places, and I'm in discussions with a couple of production companies, but really still looking for the right people that can make this come to fruition.
Okay.
So, that would be great. So I'm going to say originally we could just keep it to the continental US, looking at some of these the ancient sites, powerful places in nature, because what is happening is that with the latest scientific measuring equipment, we can start to measure some of these subtle finer forces. That when you start to examine these ancient sites, you become aware that that's what our ancestors were definitely harnessing in various different ways. The kind of earth energies, which you had a number of guests discuss, the places in nature where we feel uplifted, and there's various things like negative ions that come off of waterfalls and when we're by the ocean. These kind of places lead us into a greater place of creativity, this kind of thing. So bringing an awareness out there to how we feel different in a city, in different natural environments, what our ancestors might have been doing at sacred places, where these places are that are close to us that don't involve perhaps international travel, which is very expensive. It's not possible for everybody to go to Egypt, or they don't want to. So how can we make it more meaningful and accessible? And that's really what I want to drill down into.
All right. Well, good luck there. And Robert, you mentioned your trip to Indonesia. Tell us about that.
Well, I had the opportunity recently with Katie, my wife. This was December. So when was that? The month before last, to travel to Indonesia to attend a conference and an official site visit to this incredible site, which is known as Gunung Padang. And it is a megalithic site. I was very skeptical about it. I shouldn't say very skeptical, but I always go into these things not knowing what to expect. Is it the real thing? Is it something that is mistakenly identified as something it really is not? Or it could be a downright fraud. And what I found here is that this is a genuine megalithic site that I am convinced by the research that's being done by the Indonesian geologists goes back to the period I've been working on, which is the end of the last ice age and earlier. So we're talking 12,000 plus years ago, 10,000 plus BC, and seems to tie in with what we're finding around the world, that there was an advanced civilization around the world at the end of the last ice age. I know before the break you were talking to Gary about catastrophes and and whatnot, and I am super excited about Gunung Padang because I think it ties right in with this bigger picture. So if I could describe it very briefly, it looks sort of like a big step pyramid. And it combines characteristics of a step pyramid. People know about step pyramids from either Egypt or from Central and South America, in particular things like Chichen Itza, that's another step pyramid. But at Indonesia, the site we have, it is built out of andesite, this sort of basaltic stone blocks, which have all kinds of electrical and resonance properties, acoustical properties also, so it ties in with things that Gary was talking about. Okay. It's built out of these blocks. Some people may know about Nan Madol in Micronesia. It's built similar to that structure in the sense that the natural basaltic rocks, technically andesite, they form big columns naturally when the lava cools. So this is volcanic rock that cools. It forms big vertical columns. But what happened at Gunung Padang is that the ancient people disassembled these naturally occurring vertical columns and they built the structure out of it. They used them as if they were big logs, sort of. You can think of building a log cabin, but instead of wooden logs, they were using these basalt columns, stone logs, laying them horizontally back and forth, building the structure there. So it's an absolutely incredible structure. The Indonesian geologists, led by a fellow named Danny Hillman, Dr. Danny Hillman Natawijaya, is his last name, if I'm pronouncing it even vaguely correctly, in Indonesian. He is a very good geologist and geophysicist. I spent a lot of time talking to him. He's actually trained in America and California, impeccable credentials. They've been doing geophysical work there. They've been doing archaeological work. They've been doing drilling, getting boreholes at the site, getting radiocarbon dates. And everything indicates that this site was inhabited possibly going back 20 plus thousand years. and including building these megalithic structures at that time. Inside it is a chamber. They haven't entered it yet, but doesn't this sound like the Sphinx? There's a chamber inside that has a passage going up to a level that was covered over at the end of the last ice age about 12,000 years ago. And they've been able to determine that geophysically. They're now trying to get permission to enter it to see what is actually inside it.
Some of these properties, Robert, do you think they were built for medical purposes to keep people healthy?
These sites?
All over the country, all over the planet.
Yeah, well, it depends on the time period you're talking about. I believe that we had a major catastrophe at the end of the last ice age, and this ties in with the sun and solar activity. I think you and I have talked about this before.
The cycles.
There was a major solar outburst at the end of the last ice age. This is what caused the incredibly rapid melting of the glaciers, incredibly rapid climatic changes. It would have set off volcanic activity, earthquake activity. And for instance, in Java, in Indonesia, where this site is, to this day, it's one of the most active volcanic areas. There's just been recent eruptions since I was last there. And so some of these early sites that go back to that period, I literally think they were built as protection for what was happening as essentially these early civilizations were collapsing, and they were trying to do their best to essentially save their skin, save something from their culture.
Yeah.
Then I believe you have later megalithic structures that were built while these concepts, while these memories were still relatively fresh, not unlike the concept going to our own history of, you know, the Cold War and the Soviet Union, people building fallout shelters, bunkers, that type of thing. So you would be building structures in case something happened again, as they rightfully might expect. They also found, I believe, that these large megalithic structures do monitor, they do manipulate, you can use them to manipulate, should we say, various frequencies, various vibrations, things that Gary was talking about, so that then they have a effect on people's consciousness, they have effect on health. The late John Burke did a lot of work on that, how pyramids, for instance, can affect things as simple, and I say simple, but it's not really that simple, but the viability of seeds, for instance, how fast they will grow, how fast they will develop. So you have a situation where there are practical uses for these megalithic structures, as well as sort of, we'll call it fallout shelters or bunkers in case of catastrophe.
So how far advanced were they, Robert, compared to where we are today?
It depends on how you define advanced. I don't want to evade the question, but I don't necessarily subscribe, as some people might, that they had the technology we have today. In fact, I'm sure they did not have the technology we have today. And what I mean by that is they did not have the type of technology we had necessarily. They may have had different technologies that we're not aware of, we don't even imagine. So a lot of people think in terms of advanced technology. So that's one aspect. You know, if you think about 10,000 years from now, what would survive, you know, what would you even recognize in terms of technology from us? You know, compact disc, I'm looking at CD or DVD right now. Would you even know what that was 10,000 years from now?
And that could be all disintegrated by the time.
That could all be disintegrated. Yeah. So really what remains are these large megalithic stone structures, and that's about it, because that's what will survive major catastrophes, major earth changes.
Upheavals,
10,000 years.
Robert, hold on for a second. We're going to take this break and come right back. Beyond Belief, that's our television program that is internet-based. You can watch it for free for 10 days at a number of programs, including all the other shows that are available. Just go to this website, beyondbelief.com. You can do that now, tomorrow, or whenever you want, beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've got Robert Schock with us and Gary Evans. Robert, the calamities that hit us, obviously we didn't have global man-made global warming then either, and I think we're almost in the same cycle. Do you see a pattern here?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I see a pattern in solar activity. The calamities that hit us at the end of the last ice age were during a period in the large-term solar cycle. And when I say large-term, I'm talking about 12,000, 13,000-year solar cycle. And I think this ties in with things like the precessional ages that Gary was talking about earlier and Walter Crittenden's work, that we go through these major cycles in our solar system and in the cosmos more generally, but there's even longer-term cycles there. And a lot of what we see on Earth, including weather patterns, including geological activity, earthquake activity, for instance, has now been correlated very tightly in some cases with apparent solar activity. These are not things people want to talk about because it's not supposed to occur according to conventional science. But we have a long-term cycle of solar activity where the sun is incredibly erratic, undergoes periods of dormancy and periods of real high activity, basically a lot of variability. We saw that at the end of the last ice age. It culminated in some major solar outbursts, major solar flares, major coronal mass ejections, which, as we were talking about before, I contend actually brought about the end of the last ice age. We went into a period of relative equilibrium for thousands of years, but now the sun is becoming very variable once again. I actually don't use the term active at the moment because that's a little misleading, because if you're following solar activity right now, some people are saying it's going dormant. I think that is not quite true. I think what is happening is it's becoming highly erratic, highly unpredictable at the moment. We even see this in the climate at this time with these extremes of weather incidents, with the extreme cold we've been having more recently, which followed quickly on relative global warming, as people refer to it. I really call it global climate change, as many people do now. Essentially, very erratic patterns of behavior. We had a major X flare just a few days ago.
We sure did. Almost a five, right?
Yes, exactly. Fortunately, it was not Earth-directed. Otherwise, it could have caused some fairly serious damage if it had hit, you know, smack onto Earth. And that was very small compared to what we will have in the future, what we have seen in the past. So,
right.
So very, very erratic sun at the moment. And I think we really need to be paying attention to this. Also, you're making me think about, but the whole business of global climate change, I think, is really been usurped by certain powers to be. I hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist.
Well, I agree with
but,
you, right?
But, you know, they're making... They're blaming the wrong source. Yes, we should cut down fossil fuels for other reasons. Yes, we should be environmentally friendly.
Yep.
I'm a co-author on an environmental science textbook. But on the other hand, to say that it's all to be blamed on humans is just not fitting of the data. We find geologically, for instance, that you have solar activity followed by global warming, followed by increases of carbon dioxide, not the other way around. So, you know, there, I think some sectors, some vested interests have actually turned things on its head. Yes, carbon dioxide will perpetuate global climate change and global warming, but it's not necessarily the first cause. I think we have to look at the sun for the initial cause
of many of these factors.
So.
And we're in this cycle, and these cycles just keep coming.
Yes, these cycles keep coming. And then this ties back to something we were talking about before. Before I forget, you were asking about the technological sophistication of these ancient cultures.
That's right.
They may not have had the technologies that we have. They may have had different technologies that we can't even recognize or understand at this point. One thing that I am convinced they were doing is they were much more sophisticated when it comes to, we'll call it, issues of consciousness, mental abilities, psychic phenomena. I think they knew how to modulate that. They knew how to sort of tap into certain things that we've lost track of. Gary was mentioning before the concept of materialism versus, for lack of a better term, sort of spiritualism. And I believe that many of these ancient cultures were much more spiritual in the sense, and I'm not even using it in a religious sense, in the sense of knowing how to manipulate consciousness, manipulate mental abilities, and dealing with these types of phenomena using, as Gary mentioned, sound vibration, using electromagnetic fields, using geomagnetism, and how that can manipulate our mental abilities. I went with one example that I was just thinking about during the break. For instance, some of these traditions have filtered down, or some of this information is filtered down through, you know, religions that have are still practiced today, but have very ancient bases. So the Buddhists, for instance, some of the Buddhist meditators and monks, they talk about having approximately 6.5 million moments of consciousness in a 24-hour day. Well, modern science, you looking at brain studies, et cetera, found, in fact, that is exactly the case as far as we can reconstruct, that the mind sort of flickers, sort of like the frames of a film, mm-hmm. in moments of consciousness, and they got the number precisely right. It's about 30 to 90 hertz cycles per second of moments of consciousness, and they knew how to manipulate and tap into that.
Robert, I want to bring Gary in here, too, and have the three of us talk about the possibility of Atlantis existing and what might have happened to that area a long time ago. But, Gary, you've had some thoughts on this, of course, and one of your websites, AtlantisEvidence.com. Tell me what you think Atlantis might have been.
Well, the best working hypothesis I've got is there is a theory that we've had this great civilization of Atlantis, possibly a few outposts across the planet. It does seem to be a global connection. And perhaps some remnants of this civilization have ended up in Egypt. And when we're talking about advanced technologies, there is plenty of evidence on the ground in Egypt of what some of those advanced technologies, consciousness technologies, we could call them, awareness-raising technologies would be. Because one of the patterns that we see at these sites across the planet is that they're using crystalline stone. That is a pattern we have in Peru, have in Egypt, it's over in Indonesia, Stonehenge, all of the sites across the UK are quite often you find crystal. So that's one element to this technology. One of the other elements is this combination with these huge megalithic constructions and water. So we start to see that there's crystal, stones, water, and then it's the location of the site. And when you get out in the field and you visit many of these places, our ancestors loved these kind of vistas overlooking valleys where there's water running through the environment, whether that be rivers. Stonehenge is a river close by. But it's also a very similar geology. You have a chalk geology there with a lot of rainfall falling on the Stonehenge environment, which can start to perhaps generate these subtle electric charges, and in a similar way to Giza in Egypt, which was a limestone geology. And we see that all of these water shafts, I mean, if you go to the Giza Plateau, the engineering underneath the ground is almost as impressive as what we see above it. And I have been fortunate to clamber around in some of the tunnels and things that aren't easily accessed. And it's just incredible underneath the ground. So we start to see these common traits across the planet, and some of the sites which I've one of the photographs on your website from Abu Sir I've shared there, we have a connection between running water flowing around this, for want of a better term, temple site. There appears to be some sloped casing stones, perhaps the remnants of a small pyramid structure, and out of these casing stones emerges this water channel, or a channel that had some kind of a liquid flowing through it. And then they were collecting it in a basin. That's the photo number 7 that I've shared. And at the site opposite Abu Sir, we have Abu Ghraib, which has these huge crystalline basins, which have holes drilled into them by the looks of it. Christopher Dunn's looked at that side of things. So there's some kind of a crystal with a liquid flowing through. And I think they understood the connection between the vibration of water, because we're 70 to 80% water. Mm-hmm. How you treated the water and the water that you consumed has an effect on your awareness. You could say whether it allows your soul to come through more clearly, or you just have this kind of greater level of clarity in your thoughts and perhaps intuitive abilities. And that would be my best guess at one of their technologies that they used.
Well, do you think the technology, Gary, backfired and something catastrophic happened to them, as opposed to some kind of natural man-made, natural environment rather than man-made?
It's quite possible, because the challenge that each of us has, even in our daily life, is to make good or bad choices. If we put it under pressure, sometimes it's difficult to make the right choice. We might need to make a personal sacrifice to make the right choice. And sometimes we make the wrong choice because we're not willing to sacrifice. And if some of these kind of vibrational technologies or the wrong kind of power falling into the hands of people, and they were used against each other. I mean, Mohenjo-Daro and sites, we have reported of some kind of ancient cataclysm or burning, whatever the case may be. And human nature is one of the things that on the self-development, or we could say the spiritual path, that we do try to raise and become a better person. So yes, it's quite possible, much as today we do turn on each other and make bad choices, and it affects many of us.
So what do you think happened? What do you think happened to Atlantis? Did it blow up? What happened?
Well, the only kind of theory that's out there is that they did have this, some kind of a crystalline technology.
Right.
Which I have to say, the evidence is on the ground in Egypt, so that there is this crystalline technology. There's calcite crystal and various different crystals being used for, you can see, different purposes built into the constructions. And so there is evidence that there's something like out of Superman that could have been taking place. And that perhaps there was this build-up of power or a miscalculation and something happened. I'm certainly more of the line of thought as Robert, that something of an extraterrestrial origin, or solar flares or something just an order of magnitude beyond the human civilization's ability to cope has come in. That seems like the sort of most grounded explanation, but perhaps a combination of a few factors.
What do you think happened, Robert?
I don't think that the two things you mentioned, either natural or man-made, are incompatible, because something that Gary's talking about, and I agree with, is that they had this technology to manipulate, I'll call it manipulate consciousness, manipulate vibrations, but they were using the natural background features of the Earth, of the world they were living in. So people may know about things like Schumann resonances, and it's very important to tie in or tap into Schumann resonances. These are electromagnetic waves at the ELF, extremely low frequency, long wavelength. Now, if you have a major solar flare, for instance, you affect the ionosphere, you affect the magnetosphere, you change this natural background electromagnetism. So if you're building a technology, let's call it a technology, that taps into that natural background, that utilizes that natural background, now some event, extraterrestrial event like solar activity, all of a sudden changes that natural background, of course that is going to affect your technology. So it may have been a combination of what they were using, what they had designed for the world they were living in at that time, if you would. And when that world changed because of extraterrestrial events like solar activity, it affected their technology, affected their consciousness. I think this ties back to the concept of major cycles of civilization and essentially civilizations coming and going. And part of it is a human component, but part of it is very definitely a natural component. And when you look at Plato's story of Atlantis, he includes both of these components, the human component and the natural disaster component.
Do you think they had flying machines?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, this is something that you certainly get a lot of suggestions that they had something like that. You have it from, of course, the Vedic, the Hindu texts and stories. You have things like the Nazca lines and the Nazca glyphs of how did they see that if they weren't up in the air. You have some glimmerings of it in the sense of, you know, people have probably seen the little glider from Egypt, the little, it looks like a little airplane that was found in ancient Egypt, dynastic Egypt. Does that harken back to something much earlier? We just don't know. Certainly they were getting around, and I have made the case very strongly that there was lots of connections around the world, transoceanic travel in very ancient times. So something's going on there.
Pretty dramatic. I don't know if we'll ever get the answers.
I don't know. I mean, that's the problem when you're going back to that such an earlier period, and there's been so much that's happened. Again, I'm thinking natural catastrophes. And what survives a major solar outburst and other natural catastrophes? It's really just the big megalithic structures. So I think we have to be careful and not think that they were doing nothing but building big stone structures. That's simply what survived. So much of their culture and technology and material wealth would just not survive.
What's that one answer, if you could get it, Robert, if that one answer that you could get answered, what would that question be?
Oh, the one answer, boy. Well, right now I'm very focused on the chamber under the Sphinx. I'd really like to get in there and see, because that could answer a lot of the questions we're talking about. So from a very pragmatic point of view, that's something that's frankly doable. It's just a political situation in Egypt. If we could get into the chamber under the Sphinx, we might have some of the answers.
That would be true.
If Casey's right.
Well, we think, you know, Casey was right about the location.
And, yeah.
He did pick another three spots total for the Hall of Records.
Right, exactly.
Bimini, the foot of the Sphinx, and somewhere in Central America.
Yes, so, exactly. And it would make sense if they were planting materials several different places to have redundancy. We do that to this day, having redundancy.
Do you find that the areas around Central America and Egypt are similar?
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very similar. And it's not just the pyramids. I wrote a book some years ago called Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, and I was very explicit that pyramids are just a symbol, if you would. Yes, there are similarities between the pyramids around the world, but one could explain that away potentially as, you know, structurally that's just a good way to build. It's not just pyramids. There are all kinds of very detailed similarities and cultural traits and mythologies and legends and stories. In fact, you get incredibly, essentially the same story around the world about earlier civilizations, cycles of civilizations, and very details of those civilizations. It's not just the Atlantis story that we have with Plato. You have the same essential story over and over. It's also very interesting, something that I've been looking at recently. You asked about what is Atlantis and where is Atlantis. To me, the really important aspect of Atlantis right now is the timing of Atlantis.
Well, that's true. Robert, thank you for being with us. I know you've got to go. Gary, you're sticking around for phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.